Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
This show is the audio of a presentation I gave a couple weeks ago in front of a live audience. It happened Saturday, June the 2nd, 2018, at the annual fundraiser for the Northern Ohio Freethought Society. A great day. We had about 100 people in attendance, and this is the presentation I gave. There's no video for the speech. There's not a YouTube link with video of it. But even though I used some slides for the live audience, I describe everything verbally, and so you're not missing anything, certainly not the main gist of the presentation, which I originally titled, I Lost My Soul on Twitter. I stuck with that title for a while, but honestly, I just didn't want to have to deal with all the pedantic people emailing me going, but if you're an atheist who doesn't believe in God, how do you believe in the soul, and how does one lose his soul on Twitter? This doesn't make any sense to me. This is just a bad title, blah, 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 blah. All right, fine. I decided I'm not going to title it that, so I changed it, okay? Now, in regard to the show itself, and I'm already preparing myself, those who get it, who understand, they can relate, and hopefully, honestly, will take the journey with me, awesome. You know, they'll hear it, and they'll assess and agree or disagree, and just join me in this sincere desire to reduce the angry white noise of the Twitterverse out there, and try to regain some balance, certainly balance in our own lives. And those who don't get it, those who won't get it, who are likely part of the very problem I'm about to address, they're probably going to eagerly misunderstand, and they might misrepresent me, and then in their own lives represent for themselves the very thing I am bitching about in the content of the speech. And I'm not stupid. I'm not the guy who can solve this problem for the whole world. I'm just sharing a perspective. This is my own journey. My desire to see social media less toxic, less of a negative, a less divisive force in my own life, certainly. And I will share with you how I decided to approach it, okay? You know, I share a slide in the speech that says, it's not enough to be right. We also have to be effective. That's a perfect tie-in with a lecture series that is called Argumentation, the Study of Effective Reasoning at the Great Courses Plus. Dr. David Zarefsky, he goes pretty deep. I mean, actually, he goes really deep into breaking down how we present and defend our positions honestly and without rendering ourselves ineffective because we're using poor tactics or logical fallacies, or we have some other flaws in how we present it or how we're thinking. He's got a whole specific section on the differences between how you debate experts and how you debate friends. These are totally different animals. You do them totally differently. You handle them in different ways. Argumentation, the study of effective reasoning. It's a tool to help us reason and present reason more effectively. And it's just one of over 10,000 lectures at the Great Courses Plus, available to download to your TV, computer, laptop, smartphone, or like a podcast with their smartphone app. It is a university that comes right to you, that never closes. No tests, no pressure, no stress, and a ton of different lecture categories to choose from. And as one of my listeners, you can get started with a free trial of unlimited access to all of their lectures. But you have to go to my special URL. So show your support for this broadcast, explore any topic that interests you, and sign up for your free trial at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. The presentation audio is divided into two sections. There's the actual speech. And after that speech, we open up for audience comments and questions. Both are included as part of this broadcast, and I hope you enjoy it.
I've been really looking forward to today. for a lot of reasons, and this is really true. I didn't make this up. This is not a stunt or a gimmick, but I was at a sushi place in Tulsa, my hometown. It's called Kirin. And at the end of the meal, they give you a fortune cookie. And I opened up my fortune cookie. I think this was Tuesday. And it said, "This coming Saturday will be an exciting time for you." Now, I don't know what you people have in mind. Prepare the virgin sacrifice. But it's an honor. I mean, it's an honor to be a part of this day. It's an honor to be around all of you. It's an honor to be among friends. I turned 50 in April. 50. 50. No, 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 no. No. Stop. Stop that. I'm not going to redo my 50th birthday speech that I gave at the American Atheist National Convention, but I will sort of say that over these past years, I can, for the first time in my life, really feel myself changing. Advanced midlife, right? It's a science fair experiment, because every day when you look in the mirror, you're just sort of like, hey, wait a minute, was that there yesterday? Or that was there yesterday, and now it's gone. Weird stuff that you don't expect. We just went to go see the new Star Wars movie, Solo, right? There's a theater just outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's called the Warren Theater, the Regal Warren. And the upstairs balcony, you can go up and get these heated seats and they serve you food and you pay $2 extra, but it's kind of cool. Well, it's also a working bar. So in order to be able to have access to the upper level, you have to show them ID. Remember when it used to be a bad thing to get ID? Now they're like, no, you're fine, really. And I'm like, no, hang on, let me get my wallet. I really want to show you my identification so I can get up here. I'm a study in duality these days. I'm less patient about more things, and I'm more patient about other things. This is me in traffic. Slow down. What's your hurry? Right? I used to have my pedal to the floor 2 decades ago. Go, 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 go. Now, you know what I'm talking about. They're jacking around in traffic. They're going here. They're going there. They're revving their engine like they must get there immediately. And what happens when you pull up to the next stoplight? Who is there? After all of their trouble, they're still not any faster than you are, or they're jacking things up for the rest of us because they don't know how to merge. And you are screaming at them, I'm becoming that person. This is me with my religious parents, as they continue to say, you're going through a phase, it's an angry time, you're embarrassing the family. The devil is real. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. I say what I say to you in love, as a parent or brother or sister or friend or whatever. This is me on Twitter. Just exploding on Twitter. Or it used to be me. It used to be more than it is today. These days, again, I'm looking for balance. I'm desperate for balance. I'm trying to find balance. I need balance in my life. Social media, have you experienced that it is becoming the black hole that seems to suck your life and your joy, and it just becomes this slog where you almost don't want to log in. I mean, you do because of the benefits it brings to your life. I'm not unaware of the irony of someone who has had success thanks to the, for lack of a better word, miracle of the internet. I didn't know internet radio was even possible. Coming out of FM radio, I left broadcasting, FM corporate broadcasting, in 2004, grieving in my heart because I thought I'll never get to do this again, and it's my favorite medium. I'll never be able to produce a show like this again. I'll never be able to have this relationship with an audience again. I'll never be able to be in this creative sandbox again. It's over, and I went into video production. I thought that's it. And all of a sudden in 2010, someone told me that you can do a radio show on the internet and you can bypass all the big corporate players and the big money and all of the roadblocks and all of the censors, and you can just do your thing your way for your reasons at your level for as long as you want. You can do that. And I broadcast on the internet And it exploded. I mean, I'm not biting the hand that feeds me. Social media, Facebook and Twitter, keeps me connected to the audience that does not live locally. And I'm so thankful for the relationships that I have with those people. And I want to know that their lives are good. And I want to share parts of my life. I want to have those connections. But mostly these days, when I log on to especially Twitter, I just find that my temples are throbbing and my eyes are squinting and I'm shaking my head going, Jesus Christ, is this what the miracle of the internet was invented to allow us to do? The same technology that connects us in ways that many never dreamed possible. The same technology that is connecting us is also disconnecting us as human beings. A few of the problems I've brought three to the table today. The usual suspects, of course, because whenever I log on, thanks to the circles I run in, I get to hear about, you know, the Ark encounter. Ken Ham still at it. Things go right. He thanks God. If things go wrong, he blames those atheists, essentially implying that the atheists are more powerful than his God. I don't really get that. You've got this guy, Jesse Duplantis, just this week. He said he needs his followers to donate $54 million for a jet plane, his fourth, I think, so that he doesn't have to do layovers. He wants to be able to fly everywhere directly. And after all, Jesus, if he existed today, wouldn't ride on a donkey. He would likely have a Learjet. He actually used that argument. You got Franklin Graham down there who's shilling for Trump left and right. You got this woman here. She's Diane Black, Tennessee congresswoman running for governor. She says the reason that we have school shootings is porn. Porn is causing people to shoot up schools. As if they don't have pornography in other countries all around the world that don't have school shootings. But she has decided that porn is the culprit. And then this was a breaking story I talked about on the radio just 2 weeks ago, and it's awesome. It's a couple in East Jordan, Michigan. A guy named Glenn Thorman and his wife snapped a photograph or found an image on their security camera in their front yard of an angel that was obviously a sign of God's blessing. They don't know what it looks like when a moth flies in front of a security cam. They decided that this was, God wasn't using his divine power to, you know, cure cancer in children. No, he decided to send an angel to hover over the pickup in the driveway in East Jordan, Michigan. And you see the stuff, and this has been going on since I started in activism in 2009. It's the same story. Occasionally, hopefully different players for variety, but Ken Ham's been doing his thing for how long? Ray Comfort is doing a big push to bring back his series, The Way of the Master. Why are we still talking about Ray Comfort in the year 2018? And yet, there he is. It numbs the skull. We got this going on. President Trump meets with Kim Kardashian in the Oval Office to talk about prison reform. Somebody, Jerry DeWitt, shared a photograph that had been mocked up. I don't know who to credit, and neither did Jerry, or else I would do so here. But they reproduced the image in black and white, and they added Rod Serling of the Twilight Zone into the image, because that's the world we're living in. Trump tweets alone are almost reason to cancel your account. It's like, I cannot believe this is happening. And of course, he's pandering. Trump is pandering to Christians and Christian privilege. I don't think he believes a word of it. I think he just knows who his audience is. And he's pandering to specifically Christians here in the United States, getting them all riled up. And you see it every single day. And the fact that they're feeling empowered. And you're like, shit, how much more of this do I have to watch? Another source of frustration, especially online, I call them the unskeptics. And I've been guilty. Hell, we've all been guilty. There is an acronym out there, and this is a pendant that has atheist, a thoughtful, honest, ethical, intelligent, skeptical thinker. Oh, I wish that was true. Oh, I wish it was true. I wish. I was so naive when I came out of the faith. Atheist? Yeah. that smart enough to figure out the God question. Of course, they're thinking people. And of course, Matt DeLonte has phrased it so well. He's like, they essentially found the answer to what is the easiest question in the universe. So, I mean, there are a lot of atheists who are not thinkers. We've all been guilty of not thinking. Some people have made a lifetime out of it. And then the meme verse starts to reflect our lack of skepticism. So here we are on top of all the shit that we're reading about in the church. Now I'm looking at atheist pages, atheist websites, atheist resources throwing stuff out and actually becoming part of the problem. Here's a quote. This meme is always floating around, that quote by Hemingway. It says, "All thinking men are atheists." The quote is fundamentally wrong. I understand where they're going. I understand that they like to have Hemingway as a credit, you know, even despite the fact that his tragic life ended in suicide. He killed himself, put a shotgun to his own head back in 1961. Doesn't discredit the merit of his life and work, but is this really what we want to lead with? Here's another one I see. Adults with imaginary friends are stupid. We see a lot of stupidity in the world, don't we? A lot. But if someone holds a God belief, are they a stupid person or is there something else going on? I was a Christian for 30 whatever years. When I rejected my faith, did my IQ suddenly change? Did my brain physically transform? Did I have some sort of physiological change happen in me? Or was I just walking away from bad ideas and accepting better ideas? And can these conversations be reduced to stupid or not stupid? Is this what we want to lead with? Here's another meme. Atheism, the knowledge that ghosts don't exist, death is final, magic is fake, good and evil is relative, consciousness requires a brain. Most of this meme is wrong. Hell, I do the Ghost Stories broadcast, and I interview and talk to atheists. They don't believe in gods, but they do believe in spirits and a spiritual plane. Atheism is not a claim that death is final. There are atheists who believe in posthumous existence or reincarnation or something else. There are some atheists who don't believe in a god, but they believe in some form of magic. And they're still on the bubble, many of them, about good and evil, how you frame that, what those terms mean, how you define them. I mean, is this really the best we have? Another meme says, atheism is having the courage to tell people that you're not afraid of their imaginary friend. No, atheism is the lack of a belief in gods, period. That's all it is. It doesn't mean that you have courage. You might be afraid. You might spend your whole life not saying a word to anyone about your non-belief, and you would still be an atheist. Here's one. Of course I believe Christians get their morals from the Bible. That's why they make up 78% of the prison population in the USA. The atheist, 0.07%. Boom. Taking a self-reported label from a 2015 federal prison survey. It's a flawed survey, or at least an incomplete one anyway, because of the way people are encouraged to report. But we're talking about cultural Christians. People who are in prison for murder and rape and theft and all these things, they are there because they are Christian. Look at all the Christians in jail and look at all the atheists who are not. Boom, we got you. Is this really the best we have? There was no attempt to look at the religiosity of poor neighborhoods and how they cling to religious belief, even culturally, without really knowing what they say they believe because it gives them comfort. They have a shitty life now, but they'll have a beautiful life one day. Poor education, the lack of opportunities, bigotry, and the cycle of criminal behavior, which must include geography, family history, income, race, resources, and the often locked-off world in which troubled people are raised and live. Here's one I can't even figure out. This meme says, "Ever wondered why there are no characters from the Bible, Torah, or Quran in museums? It's because museums only display facts, not fictions or fantasies." And then they've drawn three circles. There's no Yahweh here, no Jesus here, no Muhammad here. What is this supposed to mean? Museums display exhibits, icons that represent what history and action and cultures and what they thought and believed and how they acted, what they did. Is it saying if Islam is true, it would have had a corpse of Muhammad somewhere in the museum? Is that the argument they're making? They would have had the bones of Jesus? It makes no sense. Here's a comment on Twitter. I just screen captured this with someone. We were talking about how we don't want to lead by saying that religious people are stupid. This is not what I like to lead with at all. This person said, I like to use the words fucking retarded to describe the religious. I get that people are angry about the damage done by religion, many cases done directly to them. I understand the frustration of scrolling your social media feed and seeing the insanity. I get it. I know where this comes from. I get it. But is this intellectually honest? Is it fair? Is it right? Is it the kind of criticism that we as free thinkers want to be about? And is this going to change minds, which for many of us should be the end game? Which brings me to my third point of frustration. I call it the angry noise. And I have a feeling you're going to relate to this one. Have you ever heard of something called the 6% event? Let's say I start my day in a really good mood, okay? I'm feeling good, I'm centered, my chakras are all aligned. My chi is balanced, or whatever, okay. I'm in a good place. I get up and I step on one of those Hot Wheels cars that's on the, God damn it. I told you to put this up last night. All right, so that's, let's call it an 8% event, you know, something that kind of ticks you up a little bit. I'm out of my favorite breakfast cereal. Oh, shit, that's another 5%. And I go out and somebody's dinged the car. And I get stuck in traffic and I get bad news. And so all of these percentages, all these things start to take us to a point where we begin to become more and more and more tense. We're more and more keyed up until finally we get to 95%. And the thinking is, and I think I agree with this in many ways, that at that point, for many of us, have you ever said something small, done something small, or seen someone else encounter something that was really small, and they snapped, they flipped out, they lost their shit, they lost their mind, they totally overreacted? What are the possibilities that they were literally building tension all day to the point of 95? They were already keyed, and it just took a 6% event to tip them over 100, and they blow. They lose it. I can't take it anymore. On Twitter, it looks like everybody is starting at 95%. Everybody is this. Everybody's typing angry. They start near boiling point. Here's an example of what I see. I'm an activist. I'm wired in with activists and my audience and their audiences. And this is what I see all day, every day, all day, every day. Someone goes on Twitter or Facebook or whatever and says, here's my opinion. You're wrong. No, you're wrong. Your opinion's stupid. You're a shithead. You're trash. You're fucking trash. You blocked me. I claim victory, right? You rage quit. I win. You must be awfully insecure about what you think if you had to leave the room. Victory to me. Aren't I superior? And then the spectators, of course, have jumped in, and that thread continues for days and days and days. It goes on and on. I saw this great graphic on the internet, which sums it up. It's typing. He types until his arms fall off and he smashes his own face against the I used to be this guy. I used to be this guy. Where I saw something that was factually wrong or unjust or whatever, and I was immediately, Natalie would laugh at me. You've been arguing on the internet again? No, well, they were wrong. It's like this meme. It says, cancel all my meetings. Someone on the internet is wrong. I must correct the record. They must hear my voice on this issue so that they will then hear the wisdom and understand. And certainly they will hear me in good faith. They will analyze their own positions and agree with me at the end of the day. And we'll all hold hands and sing kumbaya together. And of course, that happens. How often are we like this on Twitter? We just kick the shit out of each other all the time. Constantly going back to check the thread, check the internet. Did they respond? Oh, God, that's the stupidest response they could have made. Hang on, I'll be right there, honey. Hang on just a second. I can't believe you would say that. You obviously have done no education. You have no education. You haven't done your research. I'm sorry you're so religious on this issue. Oh, yeah. All right, so then I leave that, and then I go back, and 5 minutes later, I check the thread. This will suck our lives. As if the future of humanity depended upon my answer in a comment section on a Twitter thread amid trillions of Twitter threads or whatever it's, you know. You're actually going to convince the troll, or you're going to make a statement. Sometimes I will, you know, if you want to make a statement, correct the record and then leave it out there so that the correction is there. But how many times do we allow others to suck us in to this machine where all we do is just fight and fight and fight and fight and fight? And, you know, I'm just done. I just am up to here. I feel exhausted in my mind and in my heart. It dehumanizes me. I'm not leaving Twitter, relax. You'll still know when the podcasts are going to release and all that stuff. But I'm just saying, I'm changing how I approach social media, so that it has more balance and so that I don't allow myself to get sucked into these black holes that never end. No one ever wins. They only escalate. Things only escalate. People treating each other so much differently than they might if they were sitting here in this room over coffee. You and I have a disagreement about something here. Would we immediately start with, fuck you, you're garbage? Of course not. No, we wouldn't. And people see this weariness and they're like, well, you know what? If you're not mad, you're not paying attention. Like, doesn't the injustice of the world rile you up? Don't you think these things need to be addressed? Don't you want to go out? Are you going to remain silent about all of the horrible things that are done, especially in the name of religion? I get this. I understand this. I'm not saying that we don't use social media to spread these messages, to counter bad arguments, to try to let other people know they are not alone in their skepticism of religion, to create community, hell, to even have a good debate from time to time, a passionate debate. Yeah, I totally want to be that guy. But as I often like to say, it is not enough to be right. We also have to be effective. Is the desire at the end of the day to be the winner? I won, you lost, you're the loser. You're stupid, I'm smart. You left, I'm still here. You had the horrible idea, I've got the wonderful idea. You're the ignorant one, I'm the enlightened one. This is not about letting the best ideas win. It's certainly not about helping people. It's about a superiority complex. I mean, are you and I going to go out and engage the world and try to lift all of the boats by rising the tide for everyone? Or is it just about winning? These little cage matches on social media where we pat ourselves on the back and everybody, no matter where they are, don't change their minds and everybody anoints themselves the winner anyway. I don't want to just be right. I want to be effective. I can walk into a room, and I've been guilty of this. I literally, in the last 4 years, have had to change how I approach religious debates because I used to walk in with a mountain of data. Have any of you done this when you're talking to a religious person? They're like, well, there's no evidence for evolution. Oh, I got this. I call my buddy, Dr. Donald Prothero, and I get a copy of his book, and I get the link to this, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to show them all the evidence, and look, here's all the facts, blah, blah, blah. We've got all this, it's a huge trail of millions of years, blah, blah, blah. Look, it's all right here in black and white. I have brought the information that is now going to rescue you from your ignorance on this issue. You are welcome. I walk in, and do their minds change?
No.
Usually not. There are exceptions, but usually belief reinforcement kicks in. They feel attacked. They think I'm coming after them. They build up and reinforce the walls. It's not enough that I was right on the facts. How do I get them to the point where they're interested enough to hear me instead of already doubling down on their own position and putting up the walls of defense? That's the difference. How often have we forgotten? And I'm guilty. I am so sorry for the times I've been guilty of forgetting that the person typing on the other end of the Twitter feed or the Facebook feed that I've been debating, you know, if I've been snarky and said something nasty or whatever, how often have I forgotten that this is a person and they have a mother and a father and they may have children and they have a career and they have a long history and they have their own baggage. Who knows what's going on in their skulls? Who knows where they live? Who knows what they've been through? Who knows what they're like in three dimensions? Instead, they're just an avatar. They're just a name. They're a nothing. They're a statistic. They're just another argument to have with someone who I'll never meet in real life. And it really doesn't matter all that much if I need to be a good person to them. I'm going to win. I want to change that about myself. If I had a disagreement in person with April here or Julie, and I'm sure we'd probably line up, but let's say you are a religious person. We were sitting here and we had a disagreement, well, even an atheist, about any hot button topic. We talk about God or the validity of the Bible, or we bring up President Trump or politics or Black Lives Matter or the problems in the atheist movement. If I was sitting across from you instead of across the world from you on Twitter, would the nature and the temperature of our conversation be, you're an idiot? You're a creatard, a retard, whatever language they use. Fuck you. You're trash. You're human garbage. I want nothing to do with you. I'm sorry you're so stupid. This is my least favorite use of the term I'm sorry, because people say they're apologizing. But you can tell, because if the next word after I'm sorry is the word you, they likely aren't apologizing one bit. I'm sorry you are so religious on this issue. I'm sorry you don't see the truth. I'm sorry you were hurt by what I said. Now, if we say, I'm sorry I hurt you. I'm sorry I took a nasty tone. I'm sorry I wasn't clear enough. I'm sorry I'm not really getting what you're saying. I'm trying. I'm sorry I really do want to figure this out. I'm sorry I'm not great at debates, so I don't always use the language I want, but I really do want to be friends when this is all over. I'm sorry I has a whole different connotation than I'm sorry you. And then we can talk Democrat, Republican, Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, Scientology, Mormon, spirituality, you know, whatever that involves. So we can talk about the stuff that's important in our lives, the atheist movement, activism, all the stuff that's just coming at us like a meteor every single day, but we talk about it like real people. And at the end of the day, we shake hands, we hug, we say, thank you, this has been a real joy. You know, you and I are very different people, but it's honestly, it was nice to be able to spend that time. And, you know, and even the people who drive us nuts, we still treat them usually differently than we would online. Sometimes we need to engage. Sometimes we must get good and pissed. Anger can be a great motivator. And of course, in a binary world, when people aren't really hearing what I'm trying to say about the Twitterverse, they're like, well, he's saying that we should just be pushovers. We should not be true to our values and we shouldn't fight for what's right. Now, did I say any of that? Of course not. But this is the challenge of trying to be clear and communicate in the online world. People don't hear that. They hear, if you lower your voice and you try to be more kind and you see people as human beings, you're getting soft, you're a coward, or you're complicit. Sometimes it's good to get angry. Sometimes we need and should be angry. But here's my criteria for whether to activate my inner keyboard warrior or whatever. I say, first of all, am I raging? Have I had my 6% event? Am I in the proper mindset to respond? Anybody remember back when AOL first started? You would send a message or an AOL email, and it actually had the function where if it had not been read, you could click a button and it would pull the email back and they would never see it. So if you were pissed at somebody and you said something really nasty, or you sent a letter to someone and you were like, that's a bad idea, I shouldn't have done that. You could look, if it had not been read, you just click and oh, it never happened. Oh, thank God. Oh. Right? Because when we're worked up, are we always at our best? Are we thinking rationally? Are we making the best decisions? Often, not so much. Am I raging? Second thing is, who am I allowing to interrupt my day? This is major. And for activists, it's really major. I don't know how many hours, days, weeks have I wasted on trolls. You know what trolls want? My time, my attention. You know how often I used to sit there thinking, well, just one more post and I'm sure they'll see the light. Or this can't be left unopposed, I must respond. Nothing accomplished, except they got more time in the spotlight, they got to feel validated, and they pat themselves on the back because somebody took time out of their busy production schedule and activism schedule to engage them on YouTube. I'm not saying that it's the big people and the little people, because I'm not a big fish. What I'm saying is there are people out there who all they will do, all they seek to do, is suck your life. Is this person engaging in good faith because they genuinely want to know? Or are they just trolling me and they love the attention and I'm happily giving them what they love? Who does it help? In a debate setting with an apologist, someone who will never change their mind, at least visit, it's apparent they will never change their mind, I don't engage. I'm not going to sit there one-on-one with an apologist and go toe-to-toe. No minds are changed, hours are lost, we're both frustrated. I will do that if there is an audience of people who are watching and listening who might be going through their own journeys and struggles and questions and whatnot, and they benefit from seeing both arguments presented, perhaps even other arguments. Maybe they even engage. That's a whole different deal. But when you're engaging, who does it help? Am I already on record? This is huge. Have I already made myself absolutely clear on this issue? If so, why am I allowing people to drag me back into the same discussion again? Life is too short. Is it a priority? If I'm putting together a video of somebody, like I just released a video of Brian Fields from Pennsylvania Atheist talking about his story, or if I'm preparing my speech to come here to the Northern Ohio Freethought Society, if I'm doing an important thing, is it a priority for me to hit the brakes so I can go have a pissing contest on Twitter with someone who is probably not interested in changing their mind? And am I part of the problem? What's my disposition? Are people watching me? Am I hurting the movement by being kind of a dick on Twitter? This is a valid question. I know it's not popular among many people because they're like, well, I don't know anybody anything. My life belongs to me. I didn't ask to be part of this movement. And I understand to a degree where you're coming from. But if the world is watching us and we're trying to show them that life without the idea of gods and dogma and church, all of these lies religion has told us, a secular life, a godless life, really does help us be better people. If we're going to attract other people, do we not have a responsibility in our lives to try to be an attractive person? Otherwise, we're asking them to walk away from a religious belief, their family, their community, a life that they've lived, beliefs they've cherished often for decades. For what? So they can come and just call each other names, insult each other online, not have any sense of belonging, and certainly not display in our own hearts goodness and joy and happiness, making memories, trying to suck the marrow out of every moment of this life because we don't believe there is a life 2.0, right? My life now is more critical. It's more critical that I laugh today and show love today and have joy today and connect with human beings today and try to build a better world today because I don't believe in a heaven. Well, am I going to help communicate that if I am ugly every time someone else sees me operate in public? When I start typing, do I look like this or do I look like that? I'm sorry, I love dogs. I just couldn't resist. And happy and an angry dog photo. And of course, I have to show you my own. These are my kids. This is Henry, and that's Rat Dog. Her name is Tootsie. And at the tender age of 50, as I'm starting to mellow, I'm kind of taking a cue from these kids. Sure, it's okay, perfectly fine. It's even appropriate to puff up and sound off and bark and snarl when the time comes. You betcha. When there's something to be alarmed about, you betcha, they've got their moments of warranted irritation. And these little 3.5-pound dogs will mess you up. But mostly, their coda for living is something I've decided to adopt in my own life, which is wag more, bark less. And when the time does come where we have to bark, when we have to really get into it, it'll mean something. Otherwise, we're just the car alarm that's always going off. And you know what happens when someone's car alarm is always going off? You stop hearing it. You tune it out. You don't even hear it anymore. You get used to it. If somebody's always wailing and freaking and screaming and F-bombing and carrying on 24/7, you just stop hearing them. And that way, when something serious does happen, it doesn't mean as much because that's their default position. You know, I'm an optimist. I'm a pushover. I really do want to be the guy who's... My wife, when we were in Alaska getting married, the officiant said, you know, Seth's kind of a soft-hearted guy. He's kind of squishy. Well, okay, I'll take that. I want to be squishy. We should all be a little squishier in our lives from time to time. We haven't become the unpleasant noise that people want to just tune out of their own lives. Negativity doesn't define us. It happens. But it's not me. It's not you. I hope it's not you. It doesn't infect us. Perhaps most importantly, it can draw people toward us so we can improve their lives and then improve our own lives as part of the human condition. To attract people, we must be attractive. And if we're humanists, the work to bring good in the world begins, I think, with cultivating the good in other people. None of us are going to get this right all the time. We're human beings. But for what it's worth, as I begin my next 50 years, I'm going to do the very best I can. Thank you very much for having me out today. I appreciate it.
Next up is the comment, question, and answer session from my presentation at the Northern Ohio Freethought Society. The audience brought lots of good stuff to the table. We'll get into that right after this. My supporters on Patreon get a totally commercial-free version of this show every single week and a bonus broadcast just for them every month. Thank you so much for your support. You can find out more and choose the amount which you would like to support with at patreon.com/SethAndrews. This is the question and answer session from my presentation June the 2nd at the Northern Ohio Freethought Society fundraising event.
Tell me your name, sir, and what's your comment or question?
My name's Ron, and my question is, do you see a theme or more prevalent circumstance for people deconverting? Is there some technique that you use that's more effective than another, or a theme of when people lose their faith?
I have found that I don't spend a lot of time in my own circle on people who are not listening. It's what is known as being doxastically closed. They are sending, they're not receiving. I'm interested in the people who are doxastically open and they're starting to question and they're interested in new ideas. Maybe they're doubting in their own mind. But, you know, going after people who are coming off the church service, walking down the church steps and trying to convince them, I think is an exercise in futility. I think we're not going to win with data. I think we have to start appealing to the human condition, which includes the heart, which means, and I know this is hard for some people who've come out of a situation where they were manipulated by the church emotionally, but we need to stop surrendering to the church the idea that feeling is a religious thing. People want to be taken on a journey. That includes the heart. So as we give them information here in the head, we're also telling our stories and talking about how good life is when you're not chained to all this crazy bullshit. And how many kids are being infected with bad ideas and never given the chance to live their own lives. And the liberation we feel when we're not living in these tiny boxes. Well, this is an experience that requires the heart. I think living loud, proud lives in our own circle is huge. You can stand out there with your placards and walk around the neighborhood, but you're going to be a lot more effective if you're just an attractive person, a good person, a moral person, hell, a fun person to hang out with, and you end up having dinner with somebody. You're not banging them over the head with a baseball bat. And it comes up in everyday conversation after they've already sort of gotten to know you. And they're like, really, you're an atheist, but you're such a nice person. They then are asking you questions. Now we're talking. people first. We're people first. And we're atheists, humanists, skeptics, all these other things later. That will come. My most favorite tactic, honestly, is not to jump into somebody else's front yard with a bullhorn and go, atheist. My thing is, I'm just going to live a loud, proud, secular life so that other people can see it. And when they see joy and goodness and love and family and all this awesome stuff, and they see it happening way outside their category, they come to me. Now they're doxastically open. Now they're interested. And that's when minds can change. So that's kind of my thing. Anybody else?
Yeah, Conrad, I was, you just pretty much answered it, but I was wondering how you were treated personally when you left your congregation, you and your wife, how were you treated as far as your family members and your church family?
I wasn't a pastor. I was a Christian broadcaster. Mostly in Oklahoma. There are three questions that people lead with in Oklahoma. Hey, what's your name? What do you do for a living? And where do you go to church, right? And so when I tell them I'm an atheist, they're just a little shocked because it's so rare for them to see one in the wild. You know, they're, what? They don't really know what to do with the atheists. They just aren't processing. My mother and father are fundamentalist believers, hardcore, and my atheist activism has cost us our relationship. I'm the one who drew the final line in the sand, but I did so because I'm a believer in boundaries. And I think, you know, many times in families, and maybe some of you have gone through this, but parents seem to, some parents and other family members will often, they will often afford themselves permission to step over the threshold of your home and life because they're a relative. I get to tell you how to live. I get to tell you that you're embarrassing us. I get to dictate what you do in regard to your children. And I get to be this constant negative force. And you have to put up with it because, you know, I'm your mother. I brought you into this world. I'm your father. I'm your sister. I'm your cousin. And that's just total crap. I think it's tragic when it happens, but no one has permission to bring negativity into my life and constantly tell me that I'm a broken branch on the family tree, that I'm going to be going to hell, I will burn forever, that I'm an embarrassment to the family. And if, and I draw this line, if we cannot respect each other despite our disagreements, I must draw a hard line and I must exclude you from my life. I don't want that. I think we can all be big kids. We can all live our own lives, live around our disagreements, celebrate what we have in common. That's what I really want. But if you won't stop this, I don't have a choice. I'm not going to live my life under the shadow of the negativity that you are bringing over my doorstep. So I will close that door and you are not allowed into my circle. And so then the burden is sort of upon them. Are they going to behave? Are they going to be respectful? And in their case, you know, they feel like if the eternal question is not answered, nothing else can be enjoyed. Nothing else can be enjoyed because he's going to hell and he's embarrassing the rest of us. And so we don't speak. They're blocked on my phone because the preaching texts were coming in. And that's hard. You know, Dad's 83 and his health is failing and Mom's 80. And I don't really know how I feel about that. I mean, I still struggle. What happens if one of them passes away and this is it? We never had that moment of reconciliation. But at the same time, you know, I love you, Mom and Dad, but you don't get to do this to me. You don't get to tell me who I am. You don't get to say that I am required to carry your mantle. My life doesn't belong to you. My life belongs to me. And I'm trying to live a truthful life on my terms as best I can. And I really feel like I'm helping people and other people are being set free. And if you could only, I wish I could bring them into this room and let them see you. I don't know if they'd really get it even then, but I just like, look at these people. They're just like you and me. They're human beings, love life, and they laugh. I got hugged more times walking into this room today than, I mean, it's amazing. It's an amazing sense of humanity here. I would hope it'd be infectious, like they'd become humanist by osmosis. At least not see us as evil, sad, joyless, pathetic, immoral people. But look at these folks. They're awesome. They're amazing folks. But, you know, that's just not the reality of it. And forgive the long answer. I tend to babble when it comes to family. But, you know, just know that family, for many of you who are going down the same journey, family often is the family that you choose. the family that will respect you and love you for who you are and support you through thick and thin and be there at your side. Sometimes family doesn't have to be on the family tree, but they can still be family. Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Corinne, and I have a question that is kind of for my generation, for like millennials and the next generation. How can we label ourselves not just as non-religious, but as atheists, as humanists, and how can we embrace that label and not be judged?
Oh, these kids today. No, I love, we actually have done shows on millennials, which I know is a term many love and many despise. I love the idea that your generation is, I'm talking like my parents, Jesus. Do you see that? I love the fact that your generation is walking away from religion. I love the fact that I've got two stepkids and they're precious kids. And while they're Christians in name, they live secular lives. It's not a thing. It's not a big deal. I think I like to use the word atheist in my life because I think it's important to normalize it. You can decide what you think. But, you know, atheism only describes what I don't believe in. And there's so much more to me than that. I hope there is. You know what? I'm a humanist. Like, if I'm an atheist and I'm a shitty human being and I hate people and I don't want to make the world a better place and I'm not interested in connection and community and all of the things that humanism brings, then what a sad, pathetic life that is. The challenge we're having with the 30 and unders is that there is a tremendous lack of urgency because religion is a non-player in their lives. Many of them were not raised in the fundamental stuff that you and I were, so they're like, it doesn't make any difference in my life. That's not that big a deal. I'm not worried about it, whatever. They're so disconnected from activism because they don't see the critical need for it. I worry a little bit that their ambivalence will allow the well-organized, well-funded religious machine to gain traction sometime during their lives. So my advice to anyone, anywhere, but especially the millennials, would be to sort of sound the bell about religious privilege, religious overreach, church-state separation, why it's important that young children be protected from brainwashing, why it's still going on, how and where it's still going on, and try to tell people, you know, this matters, we should probably stand up. And the good part is I do see a lot of activists who are millennials, and they can kick some serious ass. These people are amazing when motivated. You get them out there, and they're tireless. But we just need to remind them that the fight ain't over. One of the worst things we can do is say, well, look at the statistics of atheists and the nuns, the non-religious, it's going up. We're winning. And then we check out. That is not the time to check out. And it's going to be, I think, the 30 and unders that make that difference, whether or not it sticks. Was there somebody else? I'm not going to keep you guys here all day. You guys doing okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Hi, my name's Eric. I'm signed up as one of the 10,000 street epistemologists on streetepistemology.com. And I was just curious if you were going to do another show about street epistemology, maybe have Anthony on sometime soon. Seems to dovetail pretty well with what you talked about today, actually.
Yeah. I'm actually producing a short form interview. I say it's probably 15.
Can you explain what that is?
Yeah. Street epistemology, for those who aren't aware, is a concept that was introduced in a book by Dr. Peter Boghossian, who's a philosopher, and he wrote the book, A Manual for Creating Atheists. And it was picked up by a guy named Anthony Magnabosco, who runs a website or YouTube called Street Epistemology. And the idea is it's a way of approaching people to get them to think about how they came to their beliefs. It uses the Socratic method. Questions. How did you come to believe that? What if this? And so what it does is, instead of causing that backfire effect, as you say, you're wrong, you say, well, how did you get there? How did you come to that conclusion? Can you explain to me what that's all about? And now the burden of proof is on them, but they do not feel attacked because you're not telling them they're an idiot and all those things. You're just getting them to talk about their own belief system. And it's amazing to watch people who live an assumed faith all of a sudden realize they have no idea why they believe what they believe beyond the fact that it's something they've always done. Happens all the time. And so there are YouTube interviews of Anthony Magnabosco, and he's walking around. He's got like a live camera. He live feeds these things. And he'll just find somebody on the street. Hey, do you have a minute? I want to talk about some stuff. And they're like, oh, I got a second. Let's chat. And I'll ask him, are you religious? Oh, yeah. How sure are you that there's a God? Oh, 10. And after a few minutes of basic questions, he'll say, "How? Where are you at on the scale now?" Now, the scale is flawed, but it's still an interesting tool. And they'll be like, "Oh, I'm 7 maybe. 6, oh, man, I don't know." Now, he just planted some seeds, and they're going to go off and live their lives, and who knows what's going to happen. I love street epistemology. I don't think it's the catch-all, end-all, only way to do it, but it's a magnificent tool. I'm producing, editing an interview video with Anthony Magnabosco about street epistemology, and that's going to release in July of this year, and I will have Anthony back on the show very soon, and we're going to get into how do we talk to people out there without driving ourselves crazy, and how can we help to change minds using street epistemology. Yes?
I mean, you've talked a lot about the whole situation with your parents, and I can't imagine how hard that hurts. But you made it, I sort of made an extension on that. A, are you the only atheist they know? And B, if they were to get to know more, do you think you could move them?
I don't know if they know atheists. I know they don't hang with atheists. Yeah. Atheists, you know, you have a point. They see the label of the atheist. They're sort of that, somewhat that way about the Democratic Party, like I'm a Democrat. Oh, well, that's almost as bad as being an atheist in my family. Because they're all Fox News Christians. Rush Limbaugh, that kind of thing. And that speaks to humanizing. Dr. Ryan Cragen, who I'm always referencing, and my radio listeners will forgive me, but he was saying one of the best things we can do to change minds is just change people's social circle. Otherwise, they're just in the tribe of reinforcement. If we get them where that's why people who travel a lot are actually much more often much more well-versed about the world, and they're much more liberal in their policies. And they realize that the world is not this tiny tribe, this bubble that reinforces them, but they're thinking more globally instead of tribally. If I was to introduce them to other atheists, would they change their mind at this stage in their lives? I am not optimistic. I'm not sure how welcome they would be. But it's, you know, it'd be something I'd certainly be willing to try. I'm not sure exactly how that experiment would come together. You guys want to all go to Oklahoma for a kegger and we'll invite mom and dad and see what happens? Let's do two more and we'll call it.
My question is about... So first of all, kind of like what you were saying about your family, but what if you're in a situation where you have step family or you're in a job where everybody there is religious, what advice would you have for someone just to kind of get through their day when they sort of feel inundated with religiosity?
So do they know you're an atheist or what?
No.
Okay. They have like crosses and shit all over their cubicles. Is that what you're talking about? Have a blessed day.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, people often ask me about the workplace thing, but there's so many variables. What's your boss like? How secure is your job? How religious are your coworkers being? Is there overreach in some way? Are they finding a way in some way to passively make it a hostile work environment for you? I mean, these are all things that only you can speak to. You know, I would start small. It's funny, and I'm not saying buy my coffee mug from the thinkingatheist.com's website. I'm not saying that. But Evolve Fish is my store, and they sell this mug, and it's got this icon, the Thinking Atheist icon, and it says start thinking on it, okay? It says nothing, no, the word atheist is nowhere on there. And I have had so many people tell me that they had someone come by their cubicle and tell them how much they love their mug, and those people were religious. They're like, "I love your mug. Yeah, we should all be thinking." And of course, the guy sitting there with a big smile on his face. I think, you know, you don't have to, is it that you feel guilty because everybody else gets to be overt and you think, well, I'm applying a double standard. Am I a coward? I should have something. Or do you really want to have something on your, you know, sort of in your life that represents your non-belief in gods? A little bit of both? Yeah. Well, honestly, I think you can probably find at Evolve Fish or some other website without using the word atheist, and I know the hardcore people, the firebrands are going to kill me for this, but baby step them in. You can have things that represent your belief system without putting yourself in a position where you might actually make things worse for yourself because they're going to give you so much shit. And you can get cute about it. You can get clever. It's almost like whenever the Westboro people go out and protest and you see the Comic-Con folks come by with all of their signs, right? It's just awesome. You can use humor and you can find things that engage people and get the message across that you're pro-science, pro-secular, pro-humanity, without saying your religion is stupid. And that is sort of a nice compromise. It might be a solution. Yes?
I'm one of the millennials, and but I was raised Catholic, pretty conservative Catholic, and I came out when I was 18. I'm 23 now, and I was an atheist. And I was listening to some of your videos, and I found out that we actually had the same experience of seeing Christopher Hitchens, and that ruined religion for me. It actually, it reasoned me out of religion. I just wanted to share with you that we had the same experience with losing our faith, basically, through Christopher Hitchens' legacy.
We got hitch-slapped.
We got hitch-slapped.
Yeah. The short version of that story, I was doing graphics work in my office, and I was just having stuff in the background. Didn't know much about Christopher Hitchens, but he was intriguing. Stumbled upon a YouTube video of him debating a rabbi. 90 minutes later, my world had been turned not upside down, but right side up. Because I was like, the atheist made so much more sense than the religious guy. And before you know it, I was on my way, Christopher Hitchens, and I never got the chance to shake his hand and thank him in person. It's one of the great regrets of my life.
I only found out about him after he was dead.
Yeah.
In 2013 was when I found Christopher Hitchens, and it actually pained me a lot to find out.
It grieves me, too, because his voice is missed. I just loved his style so much. Go ahead.
My name is Bridget, and I also just have a quick comment just about your talk in general. So I kind of am adopting a better approach to social media like you are because I see people shame each other over the internet all the time, everywhere.
Call out culture.
Yes, and I agree with, and I do understand why people do it, but at the same time, it's like, well, is that the right thing to do? But I read this really great book called Shame Nation, which I do recommend people read, but the one thing that really stood out was the author was talking about a story she found on the internet somewhere, and this mother, her 13-year-old daughter was, you know, she was like, okay, you're going to be on social media now, but before you do, I want you to do something for me. So the mother had her daughter squeeze out a whole tube of toothpaste, and, you know, her daughter's having fun doing that, and then she says, okay, now put it all back in. And the daughter actually did try to, and at one point she's like, Mom, I can't do this. It's impossible. And her mom's like, she said something along the lines of, well, I want you to remember this. Because whatever you put out on the internet, you can't take it back. So you are going to make mistakes sometimes, but try to make most of what you put out there good for people. And that's all I wanted to say.
Shame Nation was the name of the book?
Yes.
Check it out. Thank you. Well, I there's going to be people who are only not interested in nuance and who are going to quote mine a portion of the presentation they just heard and say, Seth thinks we shouldn't share our opinions online. Seth thinks we should never argue with somebody on the internet. Seth thinks that we should all just be pushovers and let religion do whatever it wants. There are some people who are never going to get it. Mostly, though, I express my exasperation and frustration here as really an encouragement to the rest of you that in your own lives, if you're struggling with some of the stuff that I have struggled with as an online, largely online activist, where you crave a little more humanity in our humanity, to maybe step back, pace yourself a little bit, and find more opportunities like the one I'm privileged to have here, where we can be in the same room with people who have each other's backs, and if we disagree, whatever. We're human beings first, lifting each other up, supporting each other, and you know, if things get heated at some point, it'll mean something, and we can at least be there in the moment to be able to do something about it, and then try to translate how we treat each other one-on-one to how we treat each other in other forums, be it the internet or somewhere else. Just know, my friends, that you're a tremendous encouragement to me. You will never know what this community means to me in my life, the support and encouragement, the success I would have never dreamed of, and more importantly, the fact that you have become the family I choose. I just wouldn't trade you for anything. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you, sir.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on the Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.